This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, this is not forgiveness, redemption arcs in speculative fiction.
So I think it's fair to say that Jules and I both really like anti-heroes.
Yes, there's something that captures the imagination when you haven't got a... It's difficult to capture the imagination with a perfect hero, you know?
Yes.
Things are more nuanced than that. Things are not black and white. And then Amelia actually commented on one of our previous episodes saying that she really loved the redemption arcs. And I'm like, well, yeah, actually, me too. And I don't think we've discussed that yet. So hence this episode was born.
Absolutely, yeah. And the thing about redemption arcs is that, and anti-heroes, is that for the most part, anti-heroes do tend to have some form of redemption arc. But the redemption arc is actually kind of quite wide and used in all sorts of sort of areas and venues, all sorts of sort of characters. You even have redemption arcs with heroes sometimes as well. So we've got to ask, what is it about redemption arcs which are so interesting and so compelling?
I think it's got a lot to do with the idea of hope and the idea that there is very little that you can't come back from as a human. In a lot of ways, there's, well, you know, assuming your characters are human, your characters might not be human, but the human part of them, the part that the reader engages with, there's the moral complexity of it all as well, because, and I'll discuss it in more detail later, but there are main characters and protagonists who you will never ever forgive as a reader, but you might still really, really enjoy their redemption arc. And I'll look at the parallels later. In fact, it is worth mentioning at this point that there is a big difference between forgiveness and atonement. And so quite often atonement is the thing, you know, atonement is the golden needle. It's the thing that, that the characters who've done really, really badly can very rarely ever gain. If the worse they've behaved before, the more unlikely it is they ever manage to get atonement, because there are some things that it doesn't matter how much good you put on the scale, it never really tips the balance the other way.
No.
And then there's forgiveness. And forgiveness is different. Forgiveness is personal. Forgiveness from a reader for a character is a case of, well, actually, I know you were a bad guy, but I see you trying so hard, and I really like you as a character, so I'm willing to let quite a lot of stuff go. And
yeah,
it has very
absolutely
little to do with the character's actions in a lot of cases. I would also make one other point and say that just because a character is suffering, that's not a redemption arc. That's a character suffering. That's got nothing... You know, someone might do something really, really bad, and then for the next three books, you might grind them down to the level of, like, of microorganisms. That's just character suffering, and maybe you really enjoy that as a reader and as a writer. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's not a redemption arc. A redemption arc is when a character shows some agency in going after becoming something better than they were and going after that atonement, even if it's always out of reach.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it also plays into the fact that, and this is a point that Jules has made previously, outside of this episode though, so I'm going to reinstate it, which is that we do tend to connect with some of the bad characters, the bad guys. When I say bad characters, I don't mean badly written characters. I mean, you know, characters who are meant to represent the negative side of things. We can actually find ourselves liking them and preferring them to the hero. I think particularly this is the case in sort of older media as well. There are lots of reasons for why that might be. One thing, in particular for people who are part of the LGBT community or part of any minority, is that very often the bad characters would be given characteristics of that minority, because that was seen as other and strange. But of course, to members of that minority, you went, no, that's us. I understand this character. I understand why this character is acting in this way. Yes, it is an extreme, you know, version, but I can actually understand what they've suffered from. That's just one way in which we might suddenly find ourselves being connected to the bad guy. But it happens for all sorts of other reasons. Another thing is that there is this very common streak of making the bad character charming, of making the bad character humorous.
Yeah.
And so we find ourselves attracted to them. They might even be intentionally attractive. And because of that, we want to see them redeemed, because we know we're supposed to like the hero. We know we're supposed to like certain things, and so we want to forgive them. We want to have a reason to forgive them. And I think it is also very much worth mentioning that in fiction, we will forgive quite a lot of things because it is fiction. For example, Loki in Marvel has murdered quite a few people. Like, really, really is responsible for the death and destruction of a significant proportion of, you know, New York. And like, what was it, the first day he was there, he murdered 80 people. So, you know, not a great guy, to be honest. And yet, we love him as a character. We'll forgive him. We've seen some of his internal struggle. We've, you know, and despite the fact that he is continuously a dick, We love him, and we kind of want him to, you know, to be more, to be redeemed, to have that redemption. And every now and again, he sort of does sort of redeem himself a little bit. Now, if Loki was a real person, or if we had a real person who had killed 80 people, it wouldn't matter how funny or charming they were. We as individuals would not forgive them. We wouldn't like them. They would never be able to have redemption.
Well, no, but absolutely. If, for example, we take, say, Charles Manson, who was a real person, was incredibly charismatic and had all these young teens and 20s sort of hippies going out and breaking into people's houses and killing people. I won't go into the details, but yeah, he was responsible for a lot of deaths and a lot of fucked up shit. And guess what? We didn't keep loving him when everything came out. We put him in prison.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not obviously drawing a deliberate parallel between Loki and Charles Manson. But if we're talking levels of atrocity here, it's not a case of, oh, well, Loki's a god and he's a good-looking fella and, you know, he's really charming, and but hey, he won't kill you, so that's okay, because you've got a special connection with him. But it's the same sort of principles. It's just, obviously, it's different when it's speculative fiction.
Yeah, it's incredibly different. It's different when it's fiction in general, and we will react to characters in a different way. And because of that, but despite that, we still have this sense of conscience that comes into us when we read fiction. You know, it's why sometimes when people who play video games, they know that they can do whatever they want, but they're like, oh, I'm always going to choose the nice options because I don't want to upset or offend this other video game character. I have one friend who was playing Assassin's Creed option at one point where you can hug Leonardo da Vinci, but this friend wasn't quick enough to press the button so that he could hug Leonardo da Vinci, and so Leonardo just had his arms out and then went, oh, and put them down and goes, I understand. And he went, no, I'm sorry, Leonardo, I didn't mean... He was really upset. And so we do have this sense of conscience sometimes, even though obviously it is very separate from reality. And because of we have that sense of conscience, we want to see the main character, these characters, these bad characters, do something good. We want to see them make the right choice, because we also know that that's the only way they kind of get a happy ending as well.
Yeah. I'm going to double down on what I was saying earlier, that an actual redemption arc is where you have our bad guys actually seeking to do something good. They may not even be seeking redemption. They might just be kind of like, okay, what's happening here is so far over the line for me that I am now on the side of the good guys, the guys who've been my enemies. And that can be a very satisfying plot where you've got the heroes in an uneasy alliance with the bad guys.
Yeah.
And you know it's all going to fall down. But at the moment, it's an enemy of my enemy type scenario. And again, the Marvel and the MCU's kind of done this with Thanos and
yeah.
Pushing different factions together. And it's really interesting and it's a lot of fun. But if we're just talking about a personal redemption arc, then yes, there has to be agency involved. Otherwise, it is just a character suffering, or we're getting to know a character better and perhaps they're not as bad as we thought they were. I'll come up with examples later. But one thing I will make the point of saying is a redemption arc doesn't mean that the character becomes a good, decent or altruistic person. And it is just a case of, well, maybe I'd... Let's take an example. Let's take Severus Snape.
Yes.
Who, in my opinion, doesn't really have a redemption arc. He's like Quasimodo from The Hunchback of Notre Dame, in that he is motivated by love for a woman who will never love him back, not the way he wants her to. And that's an important thing. And it means that ultimately he is on the side of the angels, if you like. He's on the side of the good and righteous. He risks his life. He does some incredibly brave things that perhaps others would not be able to do in the same way, because Snape manages a level of emotional detachment that is absolutely essential in a spy that probably most of the rest of the Order of the Phoenix couldn't manage. However, this does not stop Snape. I went off on a video game tangent there. This does not stop Snape. Freudian slip. This does not stop Snape being a horrible bully. He bullies a child from the moment that child turns up at school. He bullies him. He hates Harry. I've heard, in fact, Alan always argues that Snape loved Harry all along. That's bollocks. He didn't give two shits about Harry. He cared about Lily. And the last thing of Lily that was left was Harry. So it was a very uneasy dichotomy within Snape's own mind that forced him to help, even though he hated him the whole time, because he was James's son. So I don't really feel that Snape has a redemption arc. He just has an opportunity to be a better version of himself, which you could argue is what a redemption arc is. And he doesn't get a happy ending, and he doesn't really deserve a happy ending, because he hasn't become a decent person. He hasn't grown or changed, really. He's just a little bit wiser. He decides that maybe he doesn't want to be part of the magical Nazi association after all.
Yeah. I do feel like there's a difference between book Snape and film Snape in that regard. In that film Snape, for me, does get a tiny bit more of that redemption arc, because he actually is less of a bully. I mean, he's still really nasty. He's a nasty piece of work.
They soften him as a character in the film.
They do soften him as a character. He's just a little bit more stern, really. And he is also does actually show protective behavior. For instance, in the third film, at one point when the werewolf attacks, he puts the children behind him and things like that. You know, so he shows these sort of instincts and that he's not actually a bad person. Whereas in the books, he is continuously very nasty, incredibly nasty, not just to Harry, whom he has issues with, but to pretty much most of the students, to the point that he's the greatest fear of Neville Longbottom. Neville Longbottom, who I should add, whose parents were tortured to insanity. Like, if your fear is one of your teachers having had that kind of horror in your family, then really something's got to be said. Snape was not a good person, and you're right, I feel like he doesn't really have a redemption arc, but I do feel that he's kind of given reason for his behavior. And it is something that I think people often falling in love with redemption. Because that's something that's definitely used quite a lot in fiction. Another example, for instance, and this is a slightly more complicated one, Magneto in from the X-Men.
Yeah.
In the X-Men movies, he gets married. He has a daughter. Okay, he's no longer going around killing people. Magneto also has an incredibly, painful past, and again is one of these characters who is coded in such a way that we understand why he's acting in the way that he does, even though he does basically want to commit mass genocide, because he himself was part of a mass genocide and is kind of pushing back. So he's an incredibly complicated character already. But in the movies, basically, he's done these acts of terrorism. But suddenly it's kind of okay because he has a wife and child, and that's framed as a sort of redemption for him.
Yeah, he can't be that bad because he loves someone. I'd like to point out that Hitler loved Eva Braun, so, one, it's the scales again. One does not balance the other, and just because someone has some points of great good, that doesn't mean they can't do terrible evil.
Yeah. But again, this is an incredibly nuanced character. It's a lot more complicated than that, but it's just an example of a case where suddenly, also there's this idea that if they do settle down, they get married, then they are kind of free of all the bad things they've done. Another example of that is Preacher with the cowboy. You remember the cowboy in Preacher?
Not really. I
Okay, well.
literally only really remember Cassidy's scenes in Preacher because it didn't interest me massively.
Fair enough. The cowboy in Preacher is this really not a very great guy. He's kind of very, very dangerous, constantly wants to murder. He literally got sent to hell. And in
Oh, the
his
assassin.
hell, yeah, that's
Yeah,
right.
okay,
In
right.
his hell, he's continuously trying to save his and his wife. And again, it was this idea that was framed, which was that he settled down and let go of his ways, and he only went back to his ways when his wife and child were fridged, when they died. And I'm like, this narrative is used quite a lot, and plays into the whole sort of a woman will redeem you idea.
Yeah.
Love will redeem you, and it doesn't
Let's
necessarily.
circle back round to that because that's actually a much bigger topic. So let's
Yeah.
circle back round to it at the end,
Yeah.
and sort of stay, because you've got a really good point there, and I forgot to add that to my list. So that's good. We'll
Yeah.
come back to it and focus on it in a bit with a bit more of a spotlight.
Yeah.
But yeah, so back to what we were originally saying, which was that a redemption arc doesn't necessarily make the cat make the character a good person, as in the case of Snape. Again, I actually really like the character, but he's very complex and nuanced, and he's not a good guy. You can't make an argument that he is really a good person at all. And
Yeah.
it is interesting, just to echo Madeline, that Dumbledore says, that Dumbledore sort of says, "You want me to keep the best part of you secret." Which, in the best part of him, was the fact that he was able to form that bond with Lily. So again, we'll circle back around to that.
Yeah.
But so focusing on neutral or bad guys who seek redemption, there's various different factors, really. One factor is aging and self-realization. Perhaps you were a bit of a tearaway in your youth, and as you grew older, you realized that the world wasn't quite how you saw it back then. You might
Yeah.
have had a big chip on your shoulder and you've done some bad things, and as you've grown older and hopefully wiser, although those two things don't go hand in hand, hopefully you've had a little bit of a turnaround on your attitudes. And I suppose you're thinking of things like someone in their late teens, early 20s commits a murder, goes to prison for it, and having served a certain amount of time comes to the realization that actually what they did was something really terrible. They didn't just take a life. What they did was they took away all the potential of that person for their future. So mm-hmm. really, it was a huge theft from the rest. I mean, to sound a little bit sort of new age, it's a huge theft of whatever they could have contributed to society as a whole. So it's not just theft of a life, it's a theft of everything that person could have been and everything their children could have been and so on and so forth, which is why in biblical terms, murder was considered such a terrible sin. It's not simply just for killing someone, it's a case of, no, you've removed potential from your own species. So, an example of that is Red in The Shawshank Redemption, which admittedly is not speculative fiction, really, although it is Stephen King. He serves life for committing a double homicide. And when he finally gets out, it's really interesting that his speech is, if I could go back and talk to that young man who I was, that angry person, and tell him what a terrible, terrible crime he was committing. But he did say, I don't feel redeemed because there isn't really any redemption for this. And that's an interesting point, I think. So there's age and self-realisation.
Did he actually commit the murder in the book then?
Red isn't the main character.
Red
is the guy who can get you things.
Yep, sorry, my head just got a little bit confused there. Right, sorry, yes.
Moving on to my next point is that when we're talking about seeking redemption, honestly, for me, the character has to be seeking redemption because they have this realization that they can be something more and that they can contribute more and they can prevent harm. It's not about them. It's not about making them feel better. It's not about assuaging this huge burden of guilt they've got behind them. That might be a side effect, but it really isn't about them. It's about them being able to do something better in the future. It's a difficult one to field. Not Madeline and I. Madeline and I are kind of buddy watching Star Trek right now.
We are.
Alan and I are rewatching Angel, and I'd really enjoy the series, but let's be honest, the entire thing is about man pain. And as much as I like it, the whole sort of Angel being sort of this dark knight seeking redemption, etc., I find that so incredibly cheesy. That's like toothachingly awkward in a lot of ways. Because his redemption is about him. Every single thing, it's I this, I that, I. It's about him all the way. It's not actually about him trying to contribute something better. So I have difficulty seeing him as a champion.
Yeah. I think two things. First of all, going back when you were talking about, you know, the reckless youth who might have done something bad and has sort of, as they've grown older and wiser, there is another form as well, which is the someone who was not in control of their faculties for whatever reason. Now, this one is used frequently in speculative fiction. So Angel's a perfect example in that I did not have a soul. I did not have a conscience, or I was hungry, or I was wild, or I was being mind controlled, or I was manipulated.
So diminished, you know, responsibility.
Exactly, diminished responsibility. Now they are free of that. They are free of whatever control or whatever, you know, was causing them to do this. Now, in reality, there are examples where that might happen. Again, you might have been abused, you might have been manipulated, you might have been drugged and things like that. You certainly don't get the whole kind of, well, I was a vampire excuse quite as much in real life.
I'll tell you, sorry, I'm interrupting there just so that everyone can know how fucking weird a lot of cases are. There was a terrible rape case in South Africa. A woman was carjacked. I won't go into the details because it is so horrific. I'd need to actually put trigger warnings on this podcast. It's that bad. But okay. When the two guys were caught and brought in, they both pleaded guilty by reason of diminished responsibility because, and I quote, "we were possessed by the devil."
Wow.
This was 15 years ago, but actually 15 years in legal terms is not actually that long ago. So people still tried this sort of argument.
Okay.
So, sorry, I didn't mean to derail you, but I just suddenly thought, oh my god, yeah, that did actually happen. Not I'm a vampire, but I was possessed by the devil.
I was possessed by the devil. I think what happened is that the diminished responsibility became very popular, and is still actually quite popular in fiction now, because we wanted these characters who had an incredible, but we didn't actually want them to be responsible for it, but we wanted them to be responsible for it enough that they actually felt the guilt, so that they could be redeemable whilst also having this terrible dark past.
Yeah.
And I think really that's where it's mostly come from.
And it is a case of, that's a good way of having a character really, really suffer and never really being able to escape that suffering, because it's a matter of self-forgiveness and, are there some things you can't ever forgive yourself for? Question mm-hmm. mark. But in the Whedonverse, if you really look at the whole sort of like vampire soul thing, there's some big plot holes there, and it doesn't entirely hold water. In my opinion. Okay, so talking about redemption, mm-hmm. this is something with a character, obviously we talked about forgiveness and atonement. Whether you think a character is redeemed or not, your mileage may vary. And one reader might say yes, and another reader would be like, hell no, nothing they do is ever going to redeem them. And it, honestly, for me, I think it depends where your line is on a horrific crime or sin or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. I also do think it depends on which characters you like.
Yeah. If you don't like a character and they commit an atrocity and then they sort of like, they suffer and they suffer and they suffer, and they might even be struggling to be a better person, you're still sat there going, nope, ain't gonna happen. Nope. She's yeah. going to hell. You know?
I mean, just to give you an example from my own writing, Zachary. Zachary obviously has done some not great things, mostly cannibalism, but also regicide. So he's got quite a way to go if he wants to redeem himself. I've got to do a lot of things to him if he's ever going to be redeemed. And I also think that for a lot of readers, he will never be redeemed. Whereas what I found was that in book one, people who liked Jonathan very much took Jonathan's point of view when it came to Zachary. They very much disliked him. They didn't trust him. They saw him 100% villain. Whereas people who preferred Rufus had a very different attitude to Zachary. And so I feel that if that remains, you know, going into book two and then eventually the future books, people will decide whether actually Zachary has redeemed himself or whether it's impossible for him to redeem himself because he may have, you know, murdered their favourite character.
I think he needs to do a few more heroic things. He needs to, you know, just personal opinion. From what you were saying there, I'm a Rufus fan. I like Jonathan, yeah. but I'm in Rufus's camp. And for the first book, the first time I read the first book, I didn't really like Zachary that much. Probably because the way it reads as if you don't actually want us to. Zachary's an antagonist of sorts.
Yeah.
And then you get onto the second book and it's kind of like, oh, well, damn it, I like Zachary now, so fine. Thanks very much for that. Making everything complicated, I really wanted a reading headache. Great. And obviously Zachary suffers a lot. A lot, a lot.
Yeah.
But I think he... Do you mind me saying this? This is really sort of kind of rude, actually.
No, go ahead.
No, it's like, as much as I love... hating watching Zachary suffer, and I realise he's got to do more, I kind of want to see him come through it with some agency and actually say, okay, well, I'm grasping for this anyway. I did those terrible things. But it's also worth me saying that the whole cannibalism whilst on Night Watch and regicide doesn't actually bother me that much. So apparently my line is like way over there.
Yeah. The thing with Zachary, which I always wanted to do with the second book, is the fact that he knows that he's done wrong. And initially he was happy to have done something wrong because he felt ultimately it was for the best of everybody else. So he was happy to be the villain of the story because he thought, I can take the blame, I can be the bad guy, and I will take the punishment when hell comes, because I honestly genuinely do think Sverin will be a better leader. Massive spoilers, guys, sorry. But what happens is that book two is very much his realization that all of his hopes and his aspirations and his beliefs are incorrect. And because he's so intensely loyal, it really has to kind of be drilled into him. And he has to lose that hope. And that was the only way that I could even begin to on a redemption path. Whether he'll actually get redemption is another thing entirely. What we do know at the end of the second book is that Rufus has decided he will forgive him. He's decided that, but again, whether when they, if they meet face to face, that forgiveness will hold remains to be seen.
Definitely. So basically, as a reader or viewer, your mileage may vary on whether a character is redeemed or not.
Yeah.
Which brings me on to the last point, and that is an awful lot of readers and viewers seem willing to accept punishment and suffering in lieu of actual atonement. And one that is a really interesting example of that, I've recently watched the Amazon Prime series, not Netflix, whoops, the Amazon Prime series, The Boys, adapted from Garth Ennis's excellent graphic novels.
Yeah.
If you've not watched it, then The Boys basically are a group of slightly enhanced, eventually, humans who help keep superheroes in line. They live in a world where superheroes are real, they're out, they're well marketed, etc. And they do, superheroes is not synonymous with good.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. And someone has to keep these people in line. So the example from The Boys is this character called The Deep, who is clearly kind of a knockoff Aquaman, but in a really, really funny way. In the series, he's an extremely good-looking bloke who has an affinity with fish and sea mammals and can hold his breath a lot because he's got gills, for example. And he is a shitty person, really, really shitty. When another superhero, a female, joins the team, he gets her alone and then blackmails her into giving him a blowjob. So,
right.
Spoilers there. And it's kind of a real shock moment when it happens. And it's impossible to sort of still look at this superhero team that she's joined, the best superhero team in the world, and see it the same way. It was her dream to be part of this, and then he's kind of done this thing to her. And obviously then you start seeing the other cracks in the entire system and how insidious it all is.
Yeah.
But he doesn't really get his comeuppance. He never actually seeks redemption. He's never really sorry. It's just he's sorry he got caught. And his popularity goes down and down and down and down until he's kind of just doing like openings of sea life centres and things like that. And he's really been put on the back burner. And he suffers and bad things happen to him. And there is one instance of what I would term sexual assault on this guy, which is really bizarre and weird and kind of gross, to be honest. And you get to the end of the series and he's almost this broken down figure. He's never sought redemption, and yet everybody seems to be okay with it. Everyone's kind of like, yeah, but we love the character. And I'm like, a genuine question, does everyone love this character because it's played by this really good looking actor? Do they love the character because they've just really enjoyed watching a fuckboy suffer, like, constantly ever since he did that stupid shitty thing? He's just suffered.
Yeah.
And does anyone really think he's redeemed? Because I'm like, no, he hasn't redeemed. You could throw him under a bus tomorrow and he still wouldn't be redeemed.
Yeah.
But I have to admit, the way it's played, I was still sat there watching it thinking, I kind of feel sorry for him and I want him to stop suffering now, you know? So they're very, very clever in how they play your sympathies. But I would still maintain that punishment and suffering is not the same as redemption.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to sort of what you were saying earlier in terms of sort of the wanting it, it plays into that idea that of previous episodes of the three motivations, and that three motivations are what makes a hero. The first is the innocent motivation, the second is the selfish, and then the third is the righteous motivation. So in order to be redeemed, if you have been a villain of some kind, villains only ever really have up to two motivations. So they'll have the pure, I want to do this in order to do this, and then, oh, now I've been thwarted, so now this is about me. So now I will get Batman, you know, that kind of villain. And then the redeemed villain is someone who ultimately makes a decision, a righteous decision, which is not about them. It's about doing the right thing. And that is where their redemption comes into it. But it is that changeover. And it's also because that changeover, the changing of motivations happens with heroes as well, possible to kind of have a redemption with heroes. It's just tends to be more noticeable, obviously, when it's a bad character. Now, punishing a character and just making them suffer a lot can actually play into that as well, because it sort of breaks them down from what they were, which can then open up possibility of them reanalyzing their behavior. But it's only themselves have decided to make a change because they realize the error of their ways, or they want to make it right, rather than just make a change because they themselves are suffering. That's when I feel the redemption has happened.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And obviously there is that piece of wisdom that says in order to learn compassion, you first have to suffer greatly. And there is something to that. I don't think that's true of everyone, but that does seem to be kind of a starting place for a lot of people.
Yeah.
In order to have sympathy, you have to have first been hurt yourself. Again, as you say, you know, suffering is not the same as atonement.
No.
So, and there are some things that, again, this is your mileage may vary thing. There are some things for which you can't atone. You can only go forward and not do those things again, in my opinion. Okay, let's have a look at some of our favourite redemption arcs, and then we'll have a look at a few that are most definitely not a redemption arc. And if we've got time at the end of that, we can talk a little bit more about redemption arcs, or lack thereof, in our own work.
So, yes, absolutely.
Okay. So, favourite redemption arcs. Would you like to go first?
Goodness me. Everything has just gone out of my head.
No, that's okay. I can go first. I have a list. I have to write things down, otherwise they would go out of my head a lot quicker. I've got a query over whether this is actually a redemption arc, but this was an incredibly influential moment for me as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to bear in mind that the first Star Wars film came out a year before I was born, and the third one came out when I was about, and obviously the original trilogy. So Return of the Jedi came out when I was about 7 or 8. It was a big family thing to get the video and watch it all together. And that, if you don't really understand the whole Anakin Skywalker, Darth Vader redemption arc, then you must have been living under a rock because I don't see how you can have avoided it. But ignoring the next trilogy that is of prequels that came after, the moment when Luke refuses to strike his own father down and become his father's replacement for the Emperor, because he believes there's something good left in Darth Vader and he does not want to become an evil puppet, when he shows the strength of his own character, something that Anakin himself should have done but didn't because he was too motivated by his own fear, that's a turning point for Darth Vader. It is the shortest redemption arc in the history of literature. It has to be. It's literally 10 minutes. It's a 10-minute redemption arc. But weirdly, that is the one, possibly because of the age I first encountered it, that's the one that really stayed with me. Because Darth Vader was frightening when you were a child.
Mm-hmm.
And there is something about this inexorable force that sees the world a certain way and will arrange everything in that direction. And it's intelligent, and it's fast, and it's far more powerful than you are. And you can't reason with it. You know, it's not a machine. This is a person. This is a person who sees things in a very specific way. And there is something definitely quite frightening about that.
Yeah.
The fact that you can break through that icy wall of logic that surrounds that person with an act of courage and kindness like that, because there is still something good in there, and then that actually redeems them. That was quite a powerful idea. Mm-hmm. However, you then get the prequel trilogies, and does everybody remember The Revenge of the Sith, you know, where Anakin goes and kills a temple full of children?
Yep.
And it's a case of, wow, I'm really not sure that 10-minute redemption arc actually really covers that. But the interesting thing is he doesn't have to cover it for all of us. We don't have to think he's redeemed his viewers. The rest of the galaxy certainly doesn't think Darth Vader's a top-notch guy after that.
No.
He's redeemed in his son's eyes. His son believed there was something good left in him and was proved right. And therefore was able to find some closure and peace with his father. Darth Vader could not have lived at that point. That would not have been a satisfying end to his story. He had to die. In some respects, I'm kind of glad he came back as a Force ghost, because, you know, he sort of became one with the Force and everything, and it showed there was enough good to overcome all the evil he'd done. That's a very hopeful message. But at the same time, did he really deserve to sit there with Yoda and Obi-Wan Kenobi?
Well,
so it's a favourite redemption arc, but I admit it's incredibly flawed.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm having a hard time thinking of my favourite redemption arc. I do kind of want to talk about, and actually this one is a little bit frustrating. I used to really enjoy a show called Once Upon a Time. I kind of fell out with it as it sort of went on a little bit. But I really, really did like it. And the first few seasons, there is a character called Rumpelstiltskin.
Yeah.
Who is not a great person. And who for the entire series kind of switches between being a good guy and being the villain. And it was one of the reasons I kind of fell out with the series, is that Rumpelstiltskin was an incredibly nuanced character who wanted what he wanted. But he was never necessarily the villain himself. He was just kind of someone who was meddling, and he becomes a lot more villainous. And originally he does sort of redeem himself, because you find out pretty much everything that he's doing is to get his son back, because his son, he lost his son, and he's desperately trying to get him back. And again, he kind of gets redeemed by falling in love, but the thing with him falling in love wasn't that, oh, actually, I've become a new person. It was, actually, we get a chance to see he's not a very, very bad person at all. He's just the way he is, but actually those better qualities are there and they can be brought out. And he sort of does redeem himself a few times. And again, I lost patience because he would redeem himself. He'd have a little arc and then the next few episodes he'd be a villain again. And it was like, oh, so close. Someone who did have a redemption arc and again then became a villain and then had another redemption arc was the main villain of the piece, who's the queen, the evil queen. And part of the redemption arc is, first of all, you find out why she did what she did. Still evil, though. So, you know, she still definitely murdered a few people. But this redemption arc, and again, it's brought about by the fact that she has a child. Now, as we've said, there were some problems with that in the whole sort of, well, just because you're a mother now doesn't necessarily mean that you haven't done those other things. And just because you've had a very dark past doesn't necessarily mean that the other things you've done are okay. But again, it's fiction. Go back to Loki and his murder of 80 people. It's fiction, so we kind of say, oh, we don't really remember those characters from season one, so it doesn't really matter that you murdered them, to be honest.
It's water under the bridge.
It's water under the bridge. And we do kind of forgive it. And she becomes one of the heroes instead. And, you know, it was very enjoyable at the time. Similarly, they did this BBC Robin Hood with Guy of Gisborne, who was played by Richard Armitage.
Yes. Yes, he was.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, was there acting and stuff going on? Because mostly I was just watching Richard Armitage wearing eyeliner.
I know. Anyway, he was a really bad person. Throughout the entire series, and then in the finale it was suddenly turned out that he and Robin were stepbrothers and that they had a brother who was born of both of their parents. And also the thing that was meant to sort of redeem Guy was Marion, even though he murdered her, but Robin sort of forgave him and they worked together. And again, I think the only thing that really allowed him to truly redeem himself was the fact he died.
Yeah. See, I have no idea what happened in that Robin Hood, and I feel now, having listened to that absolute mess that you've described, that I did right to watch it just to ogle Richard Armitage, and I'm not ashamed of that decision.
Yeah, okay, he never actually seemed to care about the fact that he definitely committed, like, atrocities. That never really changed for him. So he didn't really redeem himself. It was just he was no longer the worst person ever.
Okay, one that I feel was actually a redemption arc and was quite subtle initially,
mm-hmm.
and was very well crafted, although I think that might have been as much the actors doing as anything else, was Spike in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. What's really interesting there, and you don't realise it watching all the seasons from the first time you see it, is that his redemption arc actually starts at the very end of season two, because when he makes that temporary alliance with Buffy in order to, you know, not destroy the world, because hey, he lives there, it starts to change things. It changes this incredibly codependent relationship he'd had with Drusilla. And then it forces him to be on his own for the first time in centuries. And it forces him to really start thinking about things for himself. He's been happy to just be sort of led in a lot of ways, or at least always have this one constant in his life. So when she's no longer his motivation, he first comes back to Sunnydale looking for revenge, gets a chip put in his head. He can no longer be driven by his hunger in the same way. He can't hunt in the same way. And having that sort of, that basically being neutered, makes him have to start considering other people as human a lot more, as actually being people. So that's an interesting turn. And then obviously he falls in love with Buffy, and he falls in love with her way, way, way before he actually has a soul. There's a lot of stuff going back and forth there. But he's not so much redeemed by how by falling in love with her. In fact, falling in love with her doesn't really change who he is essentially as a person, right up until the point when he realizes, no, I've done something incredibly wrong here, which is obviously when he attempts to rape her. And what I like about it is he goes and gets his soul back himself. We think when we see him leaving that first time at the end of season six that he's going to go and get the chip taken out of his head so he can come back and wreak revenge on her for rejecting him. Actually, yeah. What he's doing is trying to become worthy of her. And then once he's got his soul, he's got his conscience, he realizes that, yes, he did some good things while he was still, like, soulless, but he did some terrible bad things as well. And he accepts the responsibility for all of those things. And ultimately, what redeems him is not the hope that he will finally get the woman he loves, but the fact that he wants to be a better person. He wants to do as much good as he can in the time he's got.
Yeah.
And I think it really works. And I don't know how much of that was premeditated and how much of it was, well, James Masters has done this. This has inspired the writers to take it in that direction. And the two things worked off each other. But I think it was one of the triumphs of the show, to be honest.
Absolutely. And I do believe that in terms of partners, Spike would have been better for Buffy than Angel, ultimately.
Yeah, I completely agree. I agree with that. Okay, so a couple that are definitely not redemption arcs, in my opinion. You'll like this one, Madeline. Not a lot. Mm-hmm. Heathcliff in Wuthering Heights.
Was that even supposed to be a redemption arc?
Well, the thing is, I've seen people describe it as a redemption arc, and I'm having difficulty seeing why it's a redemption arc, because he comes back and he punishes Kathy and he punishes everyone and he kills dogs and he disinters his lost love and he does all these terrible, terrible things. And then he starts punishing the next generation, and the fact that he holds his hand and doesn't completely destroy them, that's where people say it's a redemption arc and why he finally is rewarded by being reunited with Kathy after death. And I'm like, that's not a redemption arc. He never wanted to be a better person. He didn't care about anybody else. The only two people who were real were himself and Kathy, and everybody else could go to the devil. So, no, it's not a redemption arc. The fact that he died before he could cause any more damage, yes, it is the best thing he did, but that's not a redemption arc.
Yeah, dying so that you won't be a dick anymore is definitely not a redemption arc.
Okay, this one is probably a bit more controversial. And I am genuinely going from the first book here, but Resand. The way he acts in the first book, yes, I know in A Court of Mist and Fury, everything he did was explained apart from licking Feyre's face. And a few other really, really creepy things. But again, that's not a redemption arc. That's a case of, okay, the mirror has flipped and now we know this character a little bit better, whether you buy into his explanations or not. But he was definitely an antagonist in the first book. And tearing down Tamlin to the extent that is done does not make Resand a better person. So again, I'd argue that that is not a redemption arc.
I definitely see what you're saying with this. And I'm not going to lie, I was always really disturbed by the face licking.
How do you explain licking tears off someone's face non-consensually?
The thing that gets me about the face licking is that I can't believe I've said that. The thing that gets to me about it is that ultimately it was something that he enjoyed. He didn't do it as a necessity. Pretty much everything else he did was of some form of necessity, and he does show regret toward it. Whole face-licking thing, you know, people have said, oh, he did it so that he would ground her and stuff like that. And I'm like, yes, but he ultimately enjoyed it. And you know he ultimately enjoyed it. Because he does it again later on when they are together. It's something that he, and apparently she says, oh, you know, she likes it then. And I'm like, you didn't in the first book. But ultimately they enjoy. Now, he shows regret at the fact that he kissed her. When he kissed her, it was very much for the reason that otherwise they would have all been caught and she would have definitely been murdered. So again, there's this reason behind the action, and he shows regret that that was how their first kiss went down. And again, I'm not sure whether he shows regret about kissing or in general, but Recent is a good enough character that you would estimate that is how he'd behave. He seems pretty respectful. So I can give him pretty much all of that. But the face-licking thing has always bothered me, because he got something out of it. He got something out of it, and he didn't need to do it. He could have done a lot of other things if he just really, really wanted to suddenly shock her and get angry. For instance, okay, this is a really gross one. He could have turned around, he could have pissed against the wall.
Yep. He could have handed her a handkerchief. That would have been quite shocking, considering his character so far.
Yeah. He could have snapped at her to get a grip or something like that. He could have done all these things if he'd wanted to maintain this essence of being nasty, or if he'd want to surprise her, or if he'd wanted to ground her by disgusting her in some way. There were lots of other options. He chose an action which ultimately he enjoyed. And I never liked that. And I think the problem was he suddenly had to be too good for what he was. He didn't need to redeem himself, because he'd never actually done anything worth redeeming, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's kind of my argument. Because either everything went down as he said it did, face-licking aside, in which case he didn't need to seek redemption, or he did all those bad things and he never sought redemption. So either way, it's not a redemption arc.
Exactly. Whereas, I don't know, whether maybe it would have been a little thing if he had done so. Because they say every now and again he does these bad things. But then they no longer really seem to fit with the character. It just felt a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is, you know, I'm just going to say this. I really like those books. I do. I like Resend as a character. I loved the second book. The third book was also great for me. I know Jules absolutely hated it.
I didn't well.
You did.
I didn't hate it. It frustrated me. I think I saw everything. Anyway, we're not going down that route.
We're not going down that route. But I can definitely understand exactly what you're saying. And so, yeah, he didn't have a redemption arc, because suddenly he just didn't need to be redeemed for anything. And it was a little bit convenient. And then every now and again he does these things like, oh, he'll have to, you know, work to earn the forgiveness for that. And I'm like, does he though?
Yeah.
Really, in this situation?
Okay, let's talk about this just briefly before we talk about our own stuff. Let's talk about this love will redeem us all type trope that turns up, whereby the evildoer, for lack of a better word, falls in love with a good person and that redeems them. I think, honestly, there's mileage in it when falling in love makes them realize something about themselves and want to be a better person, even if they don't think, or more especially, even if they know there's no chance of them ever being with this person they've fallen in love with, they suddenly want to be a better person because it's opened their eyes.
Yeah.
However, the trope is not great when it's a case of this is a bad boy being redeemed by falling in the love of a good woman, and, you know, it put this idea that it's up to women to save men. So when it tips in that direction, it's really bad. When it's a case of, oh, actually, feeling like this has made me realise something about myself, I realise that I haven't behaved as well as I could in the past. And okay, we're not talking about necessarily murderers or people who like to torture small animals or whatever. It could simply be a case of, no, I've lived a callow, pleasure-seeking existence and not really given too much thought about people I might have hurt along the way, and suddenly I realised that actually that's a really bad thing, because now I have a depth of feeling to go from.
Yeah. I've got, actually, weirdly enough, I've got an example of both of those things, which is the picture of Dorian Gray.
Yeah.
And the picture of Dorian Gray, you have the book, and then there was the, I say recent movie, it wasn't recent, but it had... It had Colin Firth in it, and, oh, Dream Boy, what's he called?
I can't remember his name, but yes, I know who you mean.
You know who I mean. He's wonderful. He's got a lovely face.
Mm-hmm. He's a bit pretty.
Ben Barnes. Ben Barnes, that's it.
He's a bit pretty, in my opinion.
He's very pretty. He's a pretty boy. Sorry, that sounds really gross.
I think we like different kinds of pretty in our men. Yeah. Anyway, please carry on.
What I just mean is that he's pretty. He's got a beautiful face. He's a pretty guy. Anyway, so he played a very good. Now in the book, Dorian doesn't really redeem himself in any way. He does fall in love. And that might have kind of led him to be a better person, but he inadvertently causes the girl to commit suicide. So good job, Dorian.
Yep.
He then basically just goes around having a time of his life, and he tries to correct, say, I will live like this, I will live a better man now. But the only reason he's doing it is A, because he wants to have a new experience, and B, because actually he's frightened of the consequences catching up with him. So he doesn't actually ever really redeem himself at all.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to do better because he realizes that he's done wrong. He's just scared. In the movie, they do something a little bit different, which is that Dorian falls in love with the daughter of Lord Henry. And she kind of, at this point as well, he's started to get a little bit worried about the things that he's done and the things that he's encouraged. But he still has this very kind of deep sense of love for different people. And he starts to feel ashamed of what he's done. And he wants to make a difference. Now, up until a certain point, a lot of what Dorian did was mostly just have a good time.
Yeah.
In the movie, they make it a bit weird in that it's not just that he's, you know, being openly bisexual. You know, he's also kind of encouraging, I'm pretty sure there's incest and some other pretty nasty things, which you don't go into in the book. And I'm pretty sure in the book it was just he was being, you know, he was being bisexual.
Yeah.
And maybe taking drugs. And then, of course, he commits murder. And that kind of is on another level. But he does start to feel guilty. And so he does kind of try to redeem himself a little bit more in the movie. Book, he's just kind of sort of goes rotten and then dies.
yes. So kind of not a redemption arc with a little bit of attempted redemption arc in there somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I think probably my favorite version of a redemption arc with because of falling in love is from the film Megamind.
I don't think I've ever seen. Oh,
yeah. Don't know if you've ever seen.
Have I seen it? I don't know. It hasn't stuck with me if I did.
Big blue alien.
Yeah.
Big head. And Megamind is actually a really good movie. I do thoroughly recommend it. Now, what happens is that you have this character, Megamind, who has tried to fit in and tried to be a good person. But ultimately, he realizes the only thing he's good at is being bad and being a nuisance, basically. It's the only thing he's ever succeeded in. And he has this opposite who, Metro Man or whatever, who basically has all the powers of Superman. And so the two are constantly going head to head, and it's mostly just them having fun, to be honest. Megamind doesn't ever actually plan to win. He doesn't really know what he does. So when he does win, you know, they're all ready to, everyone's saying, okay, are we just going to be mindless drones now? Are we going to be a slave? Megamind's like, I'll get back to you on that, because he hasn't actually planned this far. He's not actually a bad person. He just knows that this is kind of the way he was raised in a prison as well, so whatever. So he goes around, he vandalizes things, he robs things, he leaves a mess, he doesn't govern very well. He kind of ends up feeling lost because his whole life has been this whole battle against Metro Man, and now without Metro Man he's just won and there's no challenge, and actually life is terribly boring and he doesn't really like it. And what happens is that he falls in love with this girl who everyone thought was Metro Man's girlfriend. And whilst in disguise, he starts dating this girl. And he starts wanting to make things better for her. And at the same time, there's this other plot where he's trying to create a new Metro Man so that he can do battle. But it is really interesting because ultimately, in trying to create this new Metro Man, he creates a real villain who is actually a really nasty guy, ultimately. And this means that suddenly, Mega Mind has to step up to save the city from this villain that he's created. And the only reason, again, he's kind of really motivated to want to do better is because he's fallen in love. But ultimately, she actually, well, not ultimately, she rejects him. And he decides that despite the fact that she's rejected him, despite the fact that he has no promise that they're going to be together, he still wants to save her. He still wants to save the city. So he does. And that's a really, really lovely and also really nice narrative about do we deserve people, which is that this villain who is created thought that because he was the hero, he deserved the girl and that he was definitely going to get her. And ultimately, that's not how it works. So that was a really nice way of using the love will redeem us trope, I think.
Cool. Another way I've actually seen it done quite well, and I won't go into it too much detail because everyone should just go and watch the films if you haven't, is Despicable Me. And
Yes.
what I love about that is it is like this alternate, almost steampunk Bedknobs and Broomsticks, whereby he doesn't actually want to adopt these three children. It's just they're necessary. And then having these three children that he adopts, with his mad lab underneath and everything, makes him confront a lot of things about himself. And he does kind of fall in love with them all. And he falls in love with the person he could be if he was a slightly better person. He doesn't give up his essential nature, but he does become a better person because of it. And it was so deftly and deftly done and nuanced that I mean, it's an absolutely charming film, and the sequels are equally good, in my opinion. So, yeah, I thought that was quite a good one. Let's talk a little bit about redemption in our own work, and then we'll have to leave.
Obviously I've mentioned Zachary. He's not the only one who has a redemption arc. There are several characters. Mostly, I think the thing with the Hamartia cycle is that I wanted to create the situation where all of them have definitely done bad things or have acted in inappropriate ways for what they thought was the greater good, usually. But hasn't necessarily resulted in the greater good. And ultimately, that again, in book two, that's why Rufus decides he wants to forgive Zachary, because he realizes what's happened is that there has been this continuous cycle where one side have done something, so the other side have done something, so the other side have done something, and it's just perpetuating this circle of hatred and revenge. And so he says it doesn't actually whether they redeem themselves or not, I have to forgive it so that I can move forward, because otherwise we're just going to be stuck in this forever and we're going to destroy ourselves.
It is very much a case of that's where forgiveness is a very personal thing, and not to be mistaken with atonement, but yeah, it's a really good point. Redemption arcs in mine.
Lucas.
You're gonna say that. See, I'm still not convinced it's a redemption arc because, again, he's motivated by love for a woman who ultimately cannot love him back in the way he wants. And yes, he does something incredibly brave and self-sacrificing, but his essential nature hasn't changed. And yeah, he's obviously done some really, really shitty things. I suppose I'm just going to put a spoiler alert on this entire episode because obviously I've spoiled the boys for people, and we've talked about the Hamartia cycle as well. So, guys, you're going into this one, there'll be a spoiler episode alert on it. But yeah, Lucas dies at the end of the fourth book. And ultimately, they could not have won, M could not have won against what they were facing if he had not done so, if he hadn't sacrificed himself. His sacrifice means that she's able to save everybody else. So yeah. It's a big deal. But his motivation for sacrificing himself was not so that she could... it's tricky. It's a bit Snape-like in the sense of his motivations are skewed. And there's a later short story whereby he's kind of like, well, yes, I know I said to go and be happy with Kieran, but I didn't think I was going to have to actually see any of that, you know?
Is that for me, the short story acts as his redemption. And it acts as his redemption. It's an emotional redemption, as far as I'm concerned. Because you're right, up until that point, he was governed by his love for her. And he wasn't necessarily thinking about what was the greater good for her. It was just about her. And if he couldn't have her, he could at least survive. But ultimately, it was still about his feelings toward her. And for me, that short story whereby he has to really look at what that means and then make his peace with it is what seals it as a redemption arc. Because he ultimately lets go. He still loves her, and that's okay, but he ultimately lets go of the hatred, which kind of that hatred for Kieran.
Yeah.
And he kind of understands things a little bit more. And also, most importantly, he lets go. He doesn't sacrifice himself for her so that she, you know, so that it's him for her. She has no idea that he's there. She has no idea, you know, this is going to have no effect on her at all. He's able to on and let go and accept what's happened and even be happy for it without gaining anything. Which again, yeah. I think is, I really, really liked that short story. It really helped me connect even more with Lucas's character.
Yeah, it was a weird one to write because it's kind of like, oh, I'm squeezing something in here really at the 11th hour. But you're right, that is ultimately his self-realization and his redemption is his acceptance. And his acceptance that everything he thought and felt about Kieran, a lot of it wasn't true. And that he'd been blinded by his own feelings.
Yeah.
The other person who kind of gets a bit of a redemption arc himself is Kieran. And it's a weird one because it wasn't really intended to be that way. Weirdly, what I'm talking about is not the end of book one when he's possessed and hits M. It's to do with him confronting his own behaviour in the past and how he hasn't, you know, he's never really tried to treat anybody badly. He's just been a bit thoughtless. But when he's realised that other people have felt about him the way he's felt about M and he's made them feel really shit about it without meaning to, and it's confronting how his behaviour has still affected people even when he's said, yeah, this is a no strings type thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not a case of, oh, I murdered people. Oh, I'm suppressing this other person and stealing their life type relationship. it's a small thing, but it's really important because until he manages to move past that in his character, he can never really be happy and he can never trust that someone who he loves could love him back in the same way.
Yeah. Like Grace kind of gets a bit of a redemption as well. And her redemption, I think, is interesting because obviously she's very unpleasant in the first book.
Yeah.
she's an incredibly nasty person. And going forward, I thought I'd always hate her, but actually I liked her, especially toward the end. Her character doesn't change, but ultimately, by facing up to what the real issue was, she's able to overcome it. Now, for me, the redemption actually comes in the fact that She ends up getting involved with this supernatural kind of thing. And she no longer blames M for that kind of for these weird shenanigans. Though usually it's M's fault. I feel like M attracts these shenanigans. But she gets involved in these kinds of shenanigans, and she brings M into it. And weirdly enough for me, her getting involved and being a pivotal role, like there was a short story obviously between her and Nick where M isn't even there, and ultimately then she does pull M in because there's some weird stuff going on and she wants M's help. But she is dealing with it on her own at one point with Nick. And weirdly enough, her dealing with this felt like a kind of redemption because it was suddenly her doing the very thing that she had really, really hurt her sister with, that she'd really kind of made ostracized M with, that she'd made M feel stupid about. And now we've done this 180 degrees whereby there she is, she's getting involved, she's doing it herself, everything, despite the fact that she has no power. And she's accepting that it's real, and she accepts M and has kind of started to encourage her, but believe her as well. For me, that was a redemption arc.
Yeah, I suppose it is in a way, and it's one of those things where redemption isn't something that just happens and you're done. It's kind of like, no, everything you do going forward is still part of that growth, because the redemption arc is about growth as a person. And from that sort of point on at the end of the first book, and obviously through the novella, and then she's supportive through everything. To the point where in the fourth book, when Amy sort of rings Grace up in a panic and says, kind of need some backup here, Grace takes off and goes up to Scotland to help, despite being completely outmatched and outgunned and outpowered by almost everybody else around her. She still rocks up to help her sister.
And also, despite the fact that she and Nick have been really, really, really traumatized by what happened to them. She goes up and she helps, which is something that book one Grace probably, well, I don't know whether she would have done, because ultimately she did love her sisters. But yeah, I think if Em had called her up saying, "Hey, I really need your help with a ghostly matter," Grace would have probably in quite a support so supportive a way. She might still have turned up, but yeah, it would have been a different situation entirely.
It wouldn't have been, I'm dropping my life to help you. It would have been a bit sort of like, oh yeah, come on, put the phone down,
Yeah,
I think.
exactly.
So yeah, I think that sort of brings us to the end of the episode for now.
Does. One thing I do want to say is actually, before we kind of leave off, were there any characters you wanted to see a redemption arc for, in anything you've ever read or watched?
That's a really good point. No, I think there's been several, but I'm the one that springs to mind. You're gonna laugh. I want to see a redemption arc for Tamlin.
No, I really do as well. I really want a redemption. And not least because I feel like his character got a little bit destroyed.
And I didn't think it was necessary for it to be, because he'd been suffering as well. Yes, he did some bad things, but I don't see the point in keeping his face ground down into the dirt. He wasn't actually like beating his spouse. He wasn't, raping people. He was just, he's not a great guy. He was a bit of a dick, but he can come back from that.
Yeah.
I just don't like the way it was done. So I kind of want to see him not necessarily get everything he wants and like 6 dozen puppies or anything, but I just want to see him come back from that a little bit.
Yeah, I also want to see redemption for Lucian. Lucian has just been really hurt periodically over and over again, but he's never been allowed to redeem himself.
Completely agree.
Yeah, or to even sort of have a look at why he behaved in the way that he behaved, which, to be honest, I think what he did is pretty much entirely justified. Given everything.
That's another one where it's just, I don't know, it's not very satisfying. And I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? A complete character arc sometimes requires a redemptive part, I think.
Which we may well get in future books in terms of Tamlin and Lucian. On the other side, and I know this one because Amelia has said this one over and over again, and I'm inclined to agree with her. I wanted a redemption arc for Draco Malfoy. Now, he kind of gets one.
It happens almost all off page or off screen, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, but he sort of gets one actually in The Cursed Child.
Yeah.
In that he kind of goes to good. And again, interestingly enough, the thing that really redeems Malfoy is his son.
Yeah.
In that he wants to do better for his son. He wants to be better for his son. But I think also it's the fact he's a grown up. And most of the things he does, he's a child, okay? He's very young, he's been manipulated. You can understand why he does what he does and why he has certain prejudices and things like that. Doesn't excuse them, but I think that a lot of people did want him to kind of get a chance to grow and to redeem himself. I do understand J.K. Rowling turning around saying, no, actually, he didn't redeem himself because she did want to just say he's just not a nice person, and there are people in the world who are just not nice people, who are not nice children and grow up into not nice adults because they continue to be racist and they continue to be bigoted, and Draco Malfoy might have happily sort of still been a, you know, would have followed that Death Eater movement if, you know, Lord Voldemort hadn't literally actually been involved, at which point Draco Malfoy was scared for his own life and for his family.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, actually, I wouldn't have minded more of a redemption for Draco Malfoy. They even sort of try to do it kind of in the films. But I believe there is a cutscene where Harry wakes up having pretended to be dead right at the end, and Draco Malfoy is the one who throws him the wand. And I really wish they'd kept that, because honestly, I think that would have been pretty cool. But no, they didn't. Draco Malfoy did not really get his redemption. He just sort of was there at the end, and things were okay.
Yeah, and you're sort of left with the feeling that they've all grown as people, and maybe he's improved but perhaps not completely changed his perspectives on a lot of things. But you know, there's a difference between being quietly racist and actually being part of the Hitler Youth, for example. So it's kind of like, oh, I'm just gonna go back to being quietly racist about, you know, muggleborns, etc. Which isn't great, but it's still an improvement.
Yes.
Anyway, we better wrap it up there. I was worried we weren't going to have enough material, Madeline. I feel like we could have talked for another hour.
I feel like we might have been able to, yeah. Before we go, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe you've got one for us this time.
Yes, last month I read a arc copy of The 10,000 Doors of January by Alex K. Harrow. It's out next month. It's out early September, and it's an excellent book. It's really, really good. It follows the story of a girl called January, strangely enough, who is living in America in sort of around 1902.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of historically set, but she finds a door, and it's a door that leads to another world. She doesn't get to go through it for very long. But it starts her thinking, and what happens is it sort of solves the mystery of her birth, because January is a mixed race girl, and she's not been subjected to quite the same level of prejudice as other mixed race children of that era, because she has a wealthy benefactor, and her father, who is black, is off around the world collecting artifacts and things for this white benefactor, a rich man who likes to collect the exotic and also sell off the exotic and make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting. It's so well nuanced. because you come to realise that January is just another item in his collection, and yet he does love her, and she does love him. There's been very little in the way of parent figures in her life. So it's all a mystery about finding who you were, finding who your parents were, and who you belong to. And it's set against this sort of portal universe fantasy where there are doors opening to all sorts of worlds everywhere. And she sort of goes on search of them. And there are some, this is an adult book, it's not young adult at all, even though you've got a young protagonist. There's some gritty, dark moments. It talks about how women are silenced a lot, and it talks about how minorities are silenced, and it looks at the racism of the time, and it manages to do it without actually using any of the pejoratives that would have been used. So that proves that that can be done.
Yeah.
And it's just an incredibly magical book. The general outlook is hopeful, and, you know, despite some of the nastier aspects of the book, for example, she gets shut up in an asylum at one point. It's about reclaiming your own power and your own voice. So I really recommend this book. It's incredibly good, and it's a great magical fantasy.
Fantastic. Well, on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening. Do leave us which redemption arcs you've really enjoyed, which redemption arcs haven't worked for you, and which redemption arcs never happened, but you really, really wish they had. And until next time, we'll say thanks very much for listening and catch you next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders. Or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.